Thank you for tuning in to the Wola podcast. I'm Adam Isaacson and have the pleasure of being here today with Jeff Ramsey, Wola's director for Venezuela. You were recently the assistant director. I think that was some sort of reverse ageism because you're only 12 years old.
31, but close.
But thank you for being on today, Jeff, because I think we do need a discussion about Venezuela. Just by way of preamble, I mean, after the April 30th, rebellion that didn't really succeed, there was a period where Venezuela kind of fell off the radar a bit. It just seemed to be, at least for those who weren't paying very, very close attention, like many of our listeners may not have been. John Bolton left the White House, and the volume of the Trump administration's criticisms of Maduro and pressure on Maduro appeared to go down somewhat. I may have that wrong. And then all of a sudden this week, you have things flaring up again as, Juan Guaido, the president of the National Assembly, the only opposition-run part of the government elected in 2015, was barred from entering along with much of the opposition. What happened this week in the Assembly?
Sure. So it was, as you say, a tumultuous week in Venezuela. January 5th was the date for the National Assembly to select its president for the year. They select a new president every year. And it was widely expected that Juan Guaido, the previous National Assembly president, would be reelected without incident. It was pretty clear he had the votes. And, despite the opposition's longstanding divisions, it seemed like, there was this understanding that, they needed to get behind him because they're, to do anything else would just put a spotlight on their already precarious position. On January 5th, lawmakers belonging to the United Socialist Party, the PSUV,
the ruling party,
alongside a faction of minority opposition lawmakers, proclaimed a new president of the National Assembly, Luis Parra. And they did this while the National Guard security forces prevented the mainstream opposition majority from entering the legislative palace. And they also did it without a clear quorum needed for the move to have any kind of democratic or constitutional legitimacy. In a separate session, Guaido and his coalition met, and he received the vote that we were all expecting with 100 lawmakers. Parra claims that he got 81, but there's definitely some fuzzy math there because 100 plus 81 is more than the total 167 lawmakers in the National Assembly. So it's become pretty clear that what was happening on the 5th was the security forces were not letting in lawmakers or their suplentes, their sort of secondary deputy lawmakers, mm-hmm. who were affiliated with Guaido, and instead letting in figures that they were able to buy off.
And you had some pretty dramatic images of Guaido, who, according to the succession lines, the United States observes as the legitimate president of Venezuela, but you have these dramatic images of him trying to scale fences to get in. I mean, how does that... But ultimately unsuccessfully, correct?
Yeah, I mean, he did not succeed on the 5th in making it into the chamber. However, on this Tuesday, on January 7th, Parra, the Maduro-selected president of the National Assembly, showed up with his minority faction and began a legislative session with his smaller group of supporters. And Guaido and his larger group showed up outside the gates. They were able to force their way through the National Guard, and Guaido was able to be sworn in the chamber. And it was just this dramatic moment. I mean, many of you have already probably seen the video of mainstream opposition lawmakers breaking through this line of National Guards women who were actually trying to keep the door shut.
Huh.
You know, there's this great video of Juan Guaido yelling at a National Guardsman saying, you know, you don't get to decide who's a congressman and who isn't.
Right.
So this really was an important moment symbolically for Guaido. You know, he's demonstrated that he certainly has more legitimate support than Parra, and he's demonstrated once again that the opposition majority has democratic legitimacy.
So we were hearing in the days running up to this that maybe the Maduro government had some plan, Operation Scorpion or something they were calling it, where they were going to try and cook up exactly what happened. Ultimately, you know, they may have succeeded for a day, but did this backfire for Maduro?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think in the long term, I'm not quite sure what Maduro gets out of this. I mean, I'm sure we'll get into this. I mean, there's lots of conspiracies about, you know, whether this was needed because, you know, Russia was really pulling for this to get more legitimacy for access to Venezuelan oil. But yeah, I mean, I think in the short term, it was beneficial for Maduro because it puts these opposition divisions on display. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, the group around Parra is much smaller, but I mean, some of them are lawmakers who, you know, for instance, the secretary of the National Assembly, and who was secretary of the National Assembly in 2017, is one of this group.
Wow.
So I mean, these are people who had significant profiles.
Given how wretched conditions are in Venezuela, how did they get? How do we think they got these opposition legislators to turn?
So, yeah, I mean, there was an important corruption scandal that broke in December of 2019, in which many of these same lawmakers were accused of taking bribes from businessmen close to Maduro. And, you know, there was an investigation announced, and most of them were expelled from their political parties.
Uh-huh.
And really, it seemed like they had nowhere else to turn. I mean, you know, as cynical as it sounds, it just seems like they were just scooped up by Maduro and essentially bought off.
After having really lost their legitimacy.
After having their legitimacy.
So, figure out what to ask next. Is it, let's ask about, well, yeah, next steps on the ground. I mean, if Guaido gets some momentum out of this week's events, what are their plans, the opposition's plans for the next week or two?
Well, see, that's the bigger problem for Guaido. I mean, really what he's done is re-energize the opposition. He's managed to change the debate over, are Venezuelans going to come to the streets in support of Guaido, or are we just going to continue to see this slow burn where their momentum just kind of slows down to a crawl? I think he's managed to change the story for the last couple of weeks, but I mean, it doesn't change the equation fundamentally. The problem is that the opposition has been very good at demonstrating their institutional democratic legitimacy, but they've not had great success at translating that into actual power on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, as we've been saying on the Venezuela program for the last year, this is going to boil down to Guaido's success in reaching out to Maduro's inner circle and key stakeholders in Chavismo and the armed forces. Without getting at least elements of the existing power structure on his side, able to turn them from Maduro, it's going to be pretty unlikely to see a transition in Venezuela.
Would you say that's more important now, that getting to people in the inner circle is more important now than more street protests, which obviously is a strategy they've been trying for several years now with minimal success, or are street protests or any other means a tool toward getting there?
I think the street protests are always useful because what you're trying to do is raise the cost of repression, mm-hmm. and lower the cost of a transition. That's sort of been the guiding strategy behind all of this. So by putting the armed forces in a position where they have to repress, their own people, and sort of risk, the ire of the population, even further than they already have. You really are making the armed forces choose a side. So that's always a useful strategy. But I think there hasn't been nearly as much work on the other side of the coin, on lowering the cost of a transition to both the armed forces and key elements of Chavismo. And that's going to boil down to off-ramps.
Two immediate questions off what you just said, and we'll take them in different order because they go in two different directions. First, can the armed forces be... Are the armed forces really forced to make a decision when the colectivos can do much of their dirty work? And the other one I'll ask is the opposition really behind this sort of reaching out to the inner circle strategy, or is there a lot of division on that? But first, I mean, the whole colectivos issue, a lot of the real repression of protesters has happened, maybe with the National Guard or the army standing by, but by other elements tied to the government, no?
Yes, especially in low-income communities, particularly in the center of Caracas around the National Assembly. We've seen images of armed or even unarmed government supporters on motorbikes, running at journalists, breaking their cameras. That's certainly true. But I just want to point out, though, that we try to shy away from sort of just slapping the label colectivos on violent government supporters, because there are many types of colectivos. Not all of them are armed. Many of them date back to the 60s and 70s, and some of them even have very uncomfortable relationships with the police and security forces. I think colectivos has become a catch-all term for three types of groups. I mean, you have colectivos that are been in Caracas and other major cities for the last 40 years, some of whom have more autonomy from Chavismo. Then you have sort of a second generation of colectivos that were really fostered under 21st century socialism and have much more affinity for the Bolivarian project. And then you have this third group of colectivos, which are essentially paramilitary organizations. They are armed government supporters. In many cases, it's police, security forces, working without a uniform and posing as community organizations.
So that's the sector that
which is exactly what So I mean, I just think it's important to kind of demysticize what a colectivo is,
right?
And I think that's important because it's part of it ties in well with the overall strategy of building bridges between the mainstream opposition and elements of Chavismo. I mean, we're not going to see a transition that simply criminalizes everything to do with this movement that has been around for the last 20 years. It's not just going to simply vanish into thin air.
Right. You have to separate one from the other.
Yeah. So that's one thing. As far as, yes, we've certainly seen colectivos, if you want to call them that, armed government supporters, as we prefer to call it.
Okay, I'll use that from now on.
Yeah, take action against protesters at key moments, and that's the supposition is that shows that Maduro can't rely on the traditional armed forces. But the truth is that in major protests that like we saw in 2017, 2014, the early part of 2019, the people that were launching the tear gas, people that were firing rubber bullets, I mean, those were the traditional police and security forces. So yes, we know that there are elements of the armed forces that are not comfortable with the status quo. I mean, we've seen half a dozen coup attempts in the last 2 years.
Right.
But so far, the people with the most interest in rising up appear to be in the least powerful position to do anything about it.
Right. This may be to an academic point, but it seems like much of the official putting down a protest is done by the National Guard and not the actual army. If that's correct, does it even matter?
Yeah, I mean, the armed forces are the military. Really haven't been as involved in putting down protests. Although You know, there were clashes in late last year and early 2019 as well in the south of the country between indigenous communities on the Brazilian-Venezuelan border and the traditional armed forces. But yeah, in terms of like the, you know, day-to-day repression, that's generally left to
especially
the police
areas,
and the National Guard. Or, you know, for the really dirty work in barrios, you know, that's left to the FAES these armed government supporters.
That's right. We didn't talk about the FAES. Explain just briefly who they are.
Sure. The FAES are a unit of the police that have been tied to extrajudicial executions. It's actually, you know, they work similarly to you know, special police units that have been accused of human rights violations in places in Central America, like the Tigres in Honduras and others that have also been accused of extrajudicial executions. And there is, you know, an element of their, I mean, the bulk of their mission is nominally on citizen security. You know, they go after street gangs, drug trafficking, micro trafficking networks, etc. But increasingly, especially in the last 2 years, they've become involved in repression and you know, spontaneous community uprisings against the government. You know, the FAES really have targeted community leaders in recent years.
Wow, that deserves more attention than it's getting. Backing up to the issue of the opposition, you made a very strong case just now for reaching out, the opposition reaching out and trying to turn people in the inner circle of Maduro. Is that something that the various factions of the opposition are coming around to?
I think there's always been lip service to the idea. But, you know, the truth is that we've seen in the last year this emergence of these kind of sporadic factions of dissident Chavismo emerge. I mean, there's a group called the Platform in Defense of the Constitution, which was made up by these former Chavista ministers. There have been a couple more higher level individuals within Chavismo, including the former Attorney General, who have, you know, split from Maduro, and they're kind of in this ether. There's really, you know, the mainstream opposition really hasn't done a whole lot with them. I suspect that's mostly for the purposes of managing their own coalition. I mean, the truth is that Guaido has a hard enough time as it is herding the cats in his own coalition without, you know, giving some kind of symbolic position to you know, someone someone affiliated with Chavismo that is certainly going to rile up the more hardline elements within his own coalition. But I think, you know, that's the kind of thing that, you know, if Guaido really wants to send a depolarizing message to Chavismo, to elements of the armed forces, you know, I think that's the kind of thing that would send the right message, is really forming more concrete bridges with these dissident Chavista sectors.
Is there a role that the international community can play in expanding this big tent and fostering dialogue in general?
Well, I think it's an interesting moment. You know, in the region, there's things have kind of become a bit stale. You know, you have the Lima group, which continues to do its thing. You know, they meet once a month and issue a strongly worded statement. You have the invocation of the Rio Treaty, which has adopted sanctions that are actually completely voluntary among member states. So, you know, again, more bark than bite. I think what's more interesting actually is what's happening in the European Union. You have a new EU Commission. You have a new High Representative for Foreign Affairs, Josep Borrell, and you know the EU is at a point where they're really looking to develop a new angle on Venezuela. Last year, we saw them adopt this international contact group, which was aimed at ensuring that pressure was paired with engagement, so that pressure wasn't seen as sort of an end in itself. Now, I think there's more interest in ceding to U.S. pressure in favor of things like more individual sanctions, against elements in Maduro's inner circle and in the armed forces. But I think the EU is going to be in an interesting position where they can seek something in return from the U.S. You know, if you want us to name, you know, 30, 40 more people to our sanctions list, fine. But we're going to need clear signals from you all that, you know, this isn't going to become Cuba, that these things aren't going to be in place for the next 50 years, and that you guys are actually looking for a political solution. And there, we may already be seeing that. You know, I think it's interesting to note that in the last 3 weeks, the U.S. has sort of adopted a different tone when it comes to the possibility of new elections in Venezuela. If you remember, there were these serious negotiations that were being organized by the Norwegian government that were first made public in April and then broke down in August.
This was in Barbados. And,
you know. Yeah, they started out in Oslo, they moved to Barbados. The line from the U.S. in all of this was, we don't think there can be free and fair elections or anything approximating free and fair elections in Venezuela with Maduro either in the country or in the presidential palace. I mean, we heard different messages on that. So, you know, Elliot Abrams, the special representative for Venezuela, would say, he would have to remove himself from the presidential palace, but he could stay in the country. He might be able to run. Pompeo and others would say things like, oh, no, he has to leave the country. He just has to, you know, get in a plane to Mexico or wherever, and then we can talk about elections. But what's interesting is that in conversations that we've had in private with, political appointees in State Department, you know, relatively high-level figures in the U.S. government, you know, there's been this opening to the idea of elections and basing a position that's more on that's more centered around electoral conditions, you know, things like a new electoral council, meaningful observation.
That the process itself, even in the run-up, the whole campaign, to be freer and fairer.
Exactly, which is really important. I mean, seriously, I mean, this is a total 180 degree shift from where we were just 6 months ago. I mean, we were having conversations with state and NSC where we would say, you know, Maduro is a red herring. What we need to talk about are electoral conditions, and you know, they would just shoot us down. So really, we're seeing a complete shift in tone, both in private and in public. I mean, Elliot Abrams gave a press conference just this week after all of the drama went down at the National Assembly, in which he laid out the conditions that the U.S. Would accept for free and fair elections, which include, you know, all of the conditions that we just mentioned.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. You highlighted that on Twitter.
It's an interesting shift. I mean, obviously, this is an important moment because under the Constitution, there need to be legislative elections this year. Mm-hmm. This is the fifth year of the fifth and final year of the mandate of the National Assembly that was elected in 2015.
So probably December?
Well,
traditionally,
the elections have been held at the end of the year, around December. There's some flexibility in electoral law in Venezuela, and you know there's this expectation that Maduro is going to move them up.
Uh-huh.
So the question is, you know, there have been negotiations in the National Assembly in November and December. Guaido and the Chavista lawmakers were negotiating the makeup of a new electoral council. The question is, can we see these conditions emerge for free and fair legislative elections? Will there be enough for the opposition to participate or not? And what will that do to opposition unity? And obviously the U.S. and the opposition would prefer these legislative elections to be paired with presidential elections.
Right.
That's the ideal. It doesn't look like it's likely at this point.
So just on the U.S., sticking with the United States, I mean, this is what Elliot Abrams has been saying from his post inside the State Department. To what extent is the Trump administration right now speaking with one voice?
Trump
administration plus Marco Rubio.
That's the problem, is that there are different factions in the foreign policy apparatus of this administration. You know, you have Rubio, who has really been pressuring, for the last 2 years, 3 years for a more hardline approach and continues to be married to that, then you have sort of the Mauricio Clever Caron types.
And the National Security Council.
National Security Council, who really see Venezuela as kind of a stepping stone to Cuba. And then you have the more pragmatic elements of the administration that understand that, you know, even if you're able to create a break within Maduro's coalition, there's still going to need to be some kind of pacted conditions for a transition to occur. There's going to have to be some kind of negotiations, even if they're behind closed doors. And in that camp, you know, we've really seen a number of stories emerge in the last couple of months of Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah, I was going to say, where's he in this?
Yeah, the president's private lawyer, in addition to conducting some interesting business in Eastern Europe and Ukraine,
right,
has been meeting with business figures that are close to Maduro, and been involved in these kind of efforts at creating a channel of communication between Maduro and Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Also, just a few weeks ago, the head of Blackwater, Eric Prince,
right,
traveled to Venezuela to meet with Delcy Rodriguez. I mean, Prince is, you know, so far the State Department and Rubio have claimed that this was something that took place without any kind of authorization from the administration. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to believe because Prince is a major Republican donor. His wife is, or no, his sister is Betsy DeVos.
Mm-hmm.
He's definitely well positioned in Trump's orbit. So, yeah, you have these different camps.
So, if you're Maduro and you're getting all these messages and other and contacts, I mean, what do you even think U.S. policy is at this point?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I think there's definitely a lot of mixed messages coming from the U.S. But I have to say, you know, our assumption going into 2020. Is that this is an election year, and that's really going to be Trump's bottom line.
Florida.
Yeah, it's going to be all about Florida. Trump is not going to do anything to put himself in a position where his perceived advantage in Florida is at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And that cuts both ways. I mean, that probably means that Trump's going to be continue to be reticent to do something drastic, like military intervention, targeted strikes, that kind of thing. But it also means that he's, you know, his incentive for getting on board some kind of negotiation, which, you know, could possibly fail, as many negotiations attempted have failed in the past, his incentives there are greatly reduced.
My impression in Florida is, though, that the key swing vote there, which are not just Venezuelan Americans, but Cuban Americans, Nicaraguan Americans, and others who watch this closely, may tend more toward the hardline opposition view of things now.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you look at the Cuban American vote versus the Venezuelan American vote, there's something like 200,000 Venezuelan Americans that will vote in 2020,
mm-hmm.
and then almost a million Cuban Americans,
right,
that'll vote. Obviously, you know, both the Cuban American community and the Venezuelan American community are not homogenous. They have very different political views. But you know, the more organized voting blocks in the Cuban American community are very closely tied to the pro embargo lobby,
right,
and are more hardline when it comes to Venezuela, because again, you know, they see Venezuela as a stepping stone towards getting at Cuba.
Mm-hmm. But Trump will not be tempted to throw them some red meat in an election year then and really crack down in some way.
That was our fear. I think it's becoming increasingly unlikely. I mean, we're just not seeing the same, you know, all options are on the table rhetoric that we saw even last year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if anything, what we're seeing is State Department and NSC, you know, both State Department and the National Security Council adopting a more similar message than we've seen in the past around, you know, yes, all options are on the table in the sense that every president always has all options on the table.
Right, right.
But you know, armed action in Venezuela is not imminent.
That's somewhat reassuring. We haven't talked about Russia, which appeared, you know, were very quick to recognize Parra and to you know, move in on this. What is Russia's role right now?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, so far, I haven't seen any other country besides Russia recognize Parra.
Wow.
So they were the first and only country to recognize Luis Parra as the head of the National Assembly. There's been, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of speculation that Russia has been pushing Maduro to put a puppet in charge of the National Assembly, because under the Constitution, new finance deals, oil deals need to be approved by the National Assembly.
Oh, and so this is a Rosneft thing.
Exactly. You know, there's been this hypothesis that Russia is seeking greater access to Venezuelan oil, and they'd like a thicker veneer of legitimacy to do that.
Wow. So, and meanwhile, I mean, China still has at least loans or oil for loan deals for another share of Venezuelan oil. I mean, it's hard to see where this is going to end up and whether Maduro's government will be left with any resources.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, there's been a lot of talk of the different motives for Russia and China in getting involved in Venezuela. I mean, I tend to think that, I mean, just from a pure realist perspective, we overestimate the sort of nefarious interests of both governments. I mean, I think fundamentally, both Russia and China are in it for the money.
It's just business.
Yeah, and if they can guarantee their access to Venezuelan oil on similar or better terms, they'd happily recognize somebody other than Maduro. And I think Maduro knows this. And, you know, I think it's part of why, you know, going back to what happened in the National Assembly and appointing this clear puppet as head of the last remaining democratic institution in the country. You know, I think Maduro's clearly counting on specifically Russia for some kind of lifeline. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a short-sighted strategy, because he has to know that, you know, Russia's not married to Maduro, they're married to the oil.
Right. Just finally, Jeff, I mean, what is happening with his daily life in Venezuela now? I mean, especially outside of Caracas. We've heard a lot about dollarization lately. We've heard about some economic relative stability. I mean, things still sound awful, but also just outside of Caracas, it sounds like electricity, even water, are hard to get. I mean, what is going on?
Yeah, so, I was last in Caracas in July. This was right as sort of the de facto dollarization that we've been seeing was people were writing stories, starting to write stories about it in major media outlets, and you know, I certainly noticed it. You know, on like previous trips to Venezuela, I was able to pay for, you know, small incidentals in dollars, and occasionally even receive change, which is a real shift.
Wow.
And that's continued since then. So there has been this dollarization in Caracas and in Maracaibo, the major cities. But, you know, that's been a bubble. You know, the truth is that this is not going to resolve the economic tailspin that Venezuela is in. You know, the people are continuing to suffer in the interior of the country, especially shortages of basic goods and medicine continue. You know, there really is a deepening humanitarian crisis in the country.
And the refugee flow increases, or at least continues at the same astronomical rate. Is the international community even close to meeting its targets for taking care of that refugee population?
No, I mean, that's been one of the frustrating things about this, is that there's been so much lip service paid to the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela and the needs of Venezuelan refugees and migrants as well. But the UNHCR and IOM appeal for last year only received about a third of the funding that they needed for an appropriate response to fleeing Venezuelans. And it's important to note that, you know, the UN is now active in Venezuela as well. There, you know, OCHA, the UN humanitarian agency, is coordinating humanitarian relief efforts in Venezuela. And again, you know, there was this small, relatively small pilot program that was announced in the latter last quarter of 2019, and it also received just about a third of the funding that they needed. So, you know, for 2020, that's one of the things that we'll be pushing for as WOLA, is ensuring that the U.S. is not just putting the money for the robust humanitarian response both inside Venezuela and for a more robust regional response to Venezuelan refugees and migrants, but encouraging other donor countries, particularly in Europe, to put their money where their mouth is as well.
I didn't see in the 2020 appropriation that was just passed just before Christmas. Is there a reasonably robust amount for Venezuelan refugee assistance?
There is in the... I have to go back and check in the Verdad Act. Mm-hmm. There is... I think it's like a couple hundred million for humanitarian aid that can be used for either the relief efforts inside Venezuela or for responses to refugees and migrants. That's important, but again, it's a drop in the bucket compared to what's needed.
And much of the rest of the international community is probably behind the United States on these donations.
Exactly.
Jeff, before we go, I mean, this was a sort of a meandering conversation. We touched a lot of topics. Is there any sort of capstone message you'd like to leave us with about this moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's going to be really important going into 2020, because this is an election year, that we ensure that Venezuela is not seen as a partisan issue. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there is a risk that Venezuela policy in the United States in this election year could be affected by sort of the anti-Trump rhetoric.
Right.
And I think, you know, to the surprise of many of us that have been following Venezuela policy, yes, the Trump administration has done has made serious mistakes mm-hmm. on Venezuela. But, you know, the people's feelings about the Trump administration shouldn't impact their support for the democratic rights of the Venezuelan people to choose their own leaders.
Thank you, Jeff Ramsey, Director for Venezuela here at WOLA, for a masterful explanation of the current moment. I appreciate having you on. Hope to have you on again soon.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for tuning into the WOLA podcast. We will be back very shortly. Thanks for listening.